This works at its best if you've got single producer into here, if we can worry about it. If you've got something reading off the network with a single thread, this works really well because you can write into here with zero contention, and that's where you get some of the best figures out of the structure. If you've got multiple things writing into here, it's the one case where you've got to manage contention on the disruptor, and what you do is you use CAS operations to update this sequence. So it has to do concurrent sets to claim the next sequence in order. If you do that, you drop the throughput of the disruptor for input by an order of magnitude. It shows the difference in contention.
So you can have a bunch of sockets in, you would say you want to have like one thread doing the actual move.
Typically I do, so I'll use non-blocking IO.
Yeah.
Have one thread reading off that and writing in. Look at some of the fastest web servers out there. They don't use thread per connection. Nginx doesn't use thread per connection. Couch of Resin doesn't use thread per connection. They all use a reactor pattern, where something is taking this in. They look at how many cores you've got on the machine. They bind a processor to each core, and they farm out the requests that way. And all the C-based applications are doing exactly what Kurt was mentioning a second ago, is they use core local memory, and they run that way, and they get far better throughput to what's going on. That's the reason why Nginx is so much faster than other web servers. Like, Resin is the only Java-based application server I know that can actually hold its own against G1 and Nginx. Because what Scott's originally from Intel. Anybody know Scott Ferguson? He's an Intel guy by background. He doesn't believe in all the hype that's normally talked about in the Java community. And he's building from a processor upwards, understanding what's going on. As a result, he's the only Java application server that can hold its own against Nginx. And everybody else is miles away. The reason why when we benchmark them, they don't look so good is because people use things like GenMeter and stuff, and that's the limiting factor.
Yeah.
If you actually use a real low generator against Tomcat, Jetty, and Resin, Resin's off in the distance. We just don't see that stuff, which is fascinating.
Can you say something about ring buffer size and GC and the structs that you put in?
Okay. Yeah, so that's an interesting one. So the way the disruptor will be structured internally, typically, is we have a great big array that represents the ring buffer, and we walk around it using it again, and inside the ring buffer we have the branch objects. So what you typically do whenever you use the ring buffer, you do a three-step process, is you claim a slot. So if you look at the API, you get to claim a slot, you then fill in the details, and you commit the slot. And committing the slot is telling all of the other event processors downstream it's ready to be processed, that event's there. And so that means you can do multiple things to that slot, and then commit it. So you can set a bunch of fields, and then send it on. You can copy in. Because if you're not using locks, when you deal with the CPU, the lowest level atomic instruction you've got is to write a single word of memory. So you can't copy a buffer, because you'll see part of it from another thread. You have to do a whole bunch of things and then write a single word in memory and observe that that one word has changed, and that lets you know that's been done. So I can write a byte buffer in here, for example. I could parse the buffer, and I could write in a couple of fields in here. I could do a number of things. You can design your event to be whatever you want. That's inside the ring buffer going through. You may even put an object in here. So I quite often see this where someone will put an object into a field that's inside there. This is kind of interesting. So let's say I'm going to go around and I'm going to reuse this over and over again. What's nice from a GC perspective is I don't need to allocate and deallocate over and over again. I just pre-allocate everything I need here once. It gets promoted to old, and it just stays there, and you just keep reusing it over and over again. There's no garbage that's going on in here. Typically, what you see is these are byte buffers, pre-allocated byte buffers. So what I do is I claim the next slot in sequence. I go to the network, and I read the network straight into my byte buffer, and then I say it's ready to be read. And that way, you can just keep going over and over again.
How do you change the size of the network?
This is kind of interesting. Profiling is the answer. Pretty much to everything, you'll find that I'll just spit that out as my answer. Tests for everything. Richard Feynman sort of put a really great description. He summed up science really, really succinctly. He says, like, it doesn't matter if you think you're the smartest person in the world. He was actually attributing this to Niels Bohr at the time. He says, you have a guess at this stage. Unless you can back it up by experimental evidence, it's still a guess. And just keep going like that. And I think it's a very good maxim to follow, sort of measure everything. There's some nice tricks and techniques you can do. So, say for example, you find out that you're a buffer of 56 bytes, for sake of argument, if you're in the finance space, will cover 99.999% of the incoming packets that you're ever going to deal with. Make it that size. What if you get a bigger one? Well, here's a nice little interesting trick. Have two pointers within this for each buffer.
You can continue with that decision. I was more interested in, like, do I make the ring buffer size 1,000, 10,000, 10,000?
Yeah. The main thing that drives that is burst conditions.
Right.
So what that is that's actually your buffer to deal with burst conditions. So you get a burst of traffic in, rather than slowing everything else down or causing back pressure, you want to make it big enough to deal with the burst. But you also want to do a very simple calculation at this stage, is you want to apply Little's Law. And at that stage, you want to work out what is the maximum response time of the system you're willing to tolerate. And that drives the size of your buffer.
Do you provide statistics in your buffer to help with that calculation?
But it's really easy to build them. So going back to this, this is another thing that I like about these sort of designs. We could make a huge topic talking about the system's design. See, by putting sequences in all of these, and these sequences are very cheap to read without involving locks, I can have a monitoring thread in my system gathering metrics on everything. I know flow rates, I know time to process, I can keep all of this in histograms, I've got a complete quantile distribution of everything going on. I can now make real decisions on tuning, because I've got all the raw data, way better than any profiler will ever give it to you for every single event. No save points, no other nonsense. I've got real data for everything, and I can drive it off that. Big subject on its own. So I can write into these, and I can go around reusing these over and over again. There's some obvious problems with this. Like, today, for example, I'm updating an object in here every single time. That is going to cause churn. So what I typically want to do at the last item of my chain is I want to null that reference, because I don't want to wait till I go run and use it again, because it's probably going to be promoted, and that's going to add to the cost. It's also kind of nasty that it's walking this way. So if anybody's used the disruptor, you'll probably see that they just use this disruptor standardly. If, for example, you're always just passing a single reference, having an array pointing to objects and the object then pointing to another object increases your GC time, especially your minor collections, because that becomes a large structure to walk. And it goes up proportionally with the size of that structure. It's a linear search problem. You can take the disruptor and take a part of it called the sequencer internally, and don't allocate yourself, but separately allocate your own array. And use the sequencer to tell you what you're using inside here, not to actually get the disruptor to deal with that. That gives you then another interesting set of problems that you can do, is that can be all taped at that point. Like, I could be just having a great big memory map file. And as I'm reading in from my network, now I don't need to worry about sizes anymore, where I'm having to pre-allocate all of these sizes. If it's a memory map file, I just use my direct byte buffer, I pass it to my socket when I do a read. For I've got an offset. I know what that offset is in that file. I can read into that. If it's direct, it doesn't involve a kernel copy. And then read from the other side. What's really nice is, imagine my system crashes now. I don't need to have actually journaled it, because it's in a memory map file. Unless I lose the entire operating system, it's not there. How do I then journal those archives off for later storage? Do I have a separate thread running, observing the fact that these counters have gone forward? I can then do a transfer to, which is a kernel copy. We call them send file under the covers in Linux. This is kind of another interesting thing, is that we were talking about this briefly earlier. We are becoming obsessed with learning Hibernate, Spring, whatever it happens to be. These are quite large and complex frameworks to learn. They fill up your head with a lot of stuff that's questionable. them as well. You can learn a lot of the stuff that's underneath this that's very, very valuable and very transferable as skills much easier than you can learn some of the other stuff. In fact, a lot of this lower level stuff is much better thought out by really smart people that you can actually go and learn great things from. Like, you want to learn anything about concurrency or anything? Go talk to people who design network cards. They're masters at it. They really, really get this stuff. And make the software people look like amateurs in comparison. So yeah, looking at this stuff is really great and really interesting. So I could put that off heap, and again, I've taken away all the GC pressure now completely. Peter's Chronicle is a good example of doing some of these techniques exactly like that. So you probably find that some of the use cases of Disruptor beyond the obvious, and things like Chronicle, they all sort of converge on a very similar set of problems that need to be solved, mostly because JVM sucks for any sort of size of memory or any sort of real performance issues.
I didn't get one point. So you kind of synchronize the task that the processor with the sequence powers.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any kind of modification, or what is if the processor is just there's nothing to do currently, or does the processor get notified or the processor?
Very good question. It's a point that I haven't gone in to explore. So these are all running. I don't want these to be going through that whole cost of being woken up. Well, these have a class internally that they read sequences with. It's called the barrier class internally. The barrier class can have one of three variants. It can yield, it can busy spin. I think these days is the back off, the busy spin, and the locking strategy. So let's take the busy spin as the easiest one to understand. Is internally, if they want to read the sequences, they just sit in a tight loop, reading that over and over again. This is the best way to get the lowest possible latency in your system. Consequences, you run a core hot. If you're in a high-frequency trading system and you want to trade as fast as possible, you don't care. The people I know in this space upgrade their machines every 3 months anyway. They don't even care about burning them out. They're usually overclocked in the first place running these sorts of things. Well, overclocked, liquid cooled, doing all sorts of crazy shit. So that's the fastest way of doing this, but it has consequences. So, for example, you have more of these than you have cores, you have a problem. You think you've got a fast system, now you've got a really slow system. Because you've got to understand the consequences of what's going on. So another strategy, and so that was the only strategy we wanted to have in the disruptor. Then we had a CI environment, and we had virtualization, and we didn't have enough cores for everything we want to run in testing. So the reason the disruptor now has got other strategies is we put them in for our CI environment. So the first one we added was a backoff strategy, which busy spins for a while, drops back to yielding, drops back to parking, drops back to sleeping. And so this is the kind of classic back-off strategy at that stage. That's really nice because there is no tie-up between production and consumption. So even though you're going to take a latency hit as you fall asleep till you wake up again, you start learning lots of interesting things about how the kernel sleeps and schedules at that stage. Because if you busy spin quite a lot, you start realizing you wish there was an instruction available in Java called pause. So when a CPU busy spins, it does a thing called speculative execution. It speculates on which web branches are going to go. This is one of the ways CPUs go fast. When you're in a busy spinning loop, you don't want it to speculate. Because if it speculates, it processes instructions beyond the point that you're at, puts them all into the store buffer, uses up a whole bunch of architectural state in the page file, your TLB cacher, different things that are going on, and then if it realizes it's wrong, it has to unwind all of that so it doesn't release it out to the memory subsystem. So it actually adds latency. The pause instruction, what it does is you're telling the CPU, don't speculate, you're probably going to be wrong on this. So inside the loop, you call the pause instruction. It also additionally pauses at a hardware level for roughly the cost of an L2 cache miss, which allows it to power down a lot of the internal components of the CPU and doesn't get so hot. So although it's spinning, it's actually taking power off the CPU. If you're using hyperthreading, another hyperthread can run on that core at the same time. This would be such an easy intrinsic to add to Java. Trying to get the high priest to adopt this is an absolute nightmare. I think there's some interesting history to some of that. So that's the spinning one. you can then start to call yield. So I'm going to talk in the context of some of the latest JVMs and the later versions of Linux. You're looking at about 300 nanoseconds cost to yield constantly. And what's that? Yield is you're being nice and you're being friendly. You're saying some other thread can run at this point in time if I'm not busy. So your system, although it's running hot, is still friendly to other threads that wants to run. But you've now taken an average of about 150 nanos between sort of possible observations of an event coming in. If you back off from that, you might want to call thread.sleep. Let me look at the thread.sleep API. There's a verse that takes milliseconds, a verse that takes milliseconds, nanoseconds. Have a look inside the code for the one that takes nanoseconds. It rounds it up to the nearest millisecond and calls a millisecond version. Got love for people who've designed some of this stuff. It's completely pointless. How can you sleep less? Well, there's a method called part nanos in lock support, and it will take a number of nanoseconds, and it will actually let you sleep for a smaller period of time. If you ask to sleep for 1 nanosecond, on a modern version of Linux, you will typically get 55 microseconds, plus whatever you ask for. So if you were to ask for 2 microseconds, you'll probably get about 57 microseconds when it actually sleeps.
It's worse for the millisecond time.
Yeah. kind of crazy stuff. So that's reasonable. And so I spent a lot of time down in the C world understanding different efficient ways of sleeping. If anybody wants to know about this, I can talk about it. But things like calling nano sleep, normal sleep, all of that sort of stuff using high performance event timers, you're typically dealing in the 10 to 50 micros. The only one that seems to get anywhere reliably lower than that is fd_createTimer. And you do a select on a file descriptor at that point. I can get down to about 2 micros at that stage, but it's still burning about 70% CPU to do that because there's a lot of system time scheduling and stuff. It would be nice if we had alternatives. So that's the sleeping, but the nice thing is I can have as many of those go independently because the whole thing is decoupling the side. When you back off, which is the blocking strategy, what the blocking strategy is, if I go to get something from there, if it's not there, it parks the thread, just like it does under a normal lock, and falls asleep at that point. So it's not going to use any more CPU. If an event comes in, they have to be awoken. And the way it awakes them is this side has to enter a lock, and it has to signal that something's available, and then wakes them up. The tough one with this is it's really hard to write an algorithm that doesn't need to do that every single time. So now you've limited the throughput in the system because you're having to notify them all every time whether there's someone waiting or not. It's quite difficult. The only one that I've seen that does a good job with that is if you actually do this on Azul, they've got some good optimizations in their lock implementation that works out if it needs to wake these up. Because some of the history is when they're done Vega, they were doing up to nearly 1,000 threads, and you really don't want to be just randomly trying to wake up 1,000 threads if you can. So they've got some nice optimizations that makes that more efficient.
What are some voice software you've seen it misused, where people use it for things that it was not suited for at all?
Yes. So the common one is over here. This is really, really fast. Now, for context, where this is designed is, when you're talking about input, my preferred way of input to most systems is multicast. That is not normal network programming for most people. Multicast. I like multicast for a number of reasons. One is, it is the lowest latency protocol that you have out there. But really, really, much more important than that is, it's very easy to design a high availability cluster. So, a big part of what I end up doing is building highly available systems as well as very fast systems. So there's other reasons why I'm interested in multicast. So for example, I can send to multiple nodes running hot at the same time. And if one of them fails, if you're using normal sockets, I've got to migrate the socket from the primary to the secondary. You can't run multi-hot-hot with sockets at any given point in time unless you run into both of them, but then you've got a linear problem with sending the data and they'll all go out of order. With multicast, you can send to them all at the same time, and if one dies, the other one just keeps going without any network flip over. Yeah. And you also don't have all of the startup. TCP is originally designed for wide area networks that are highly unreliable. If you're in a very well-controlled data center, you don't have the problems with TCP that it was originally designed for, so it's much higher latency than other other protocols.
So does that mean that your client in that case is in the same data center? Sort of
typically. So
you have something else in front of that. Or it depends on like, what's the origin of the event, so to speak.
So in a typical finance exchange, what you have is you've got a gateway that's typically talking a protocol like FIX, which is actually a socket-based tax protocol that's horrible. You think the finance industry would have gone beyond this, but yeah, so they're typically, they've got a gateway running FIX that then pumps multicast out the back to the core matching engine of the exchange. That's the typical design pattern you'll see. And so, but then gateways tend to be running things that are disruptor-like as well, where they're taking sockets in, multicast out, multicast back, socket the other as normal TCP socket the other
so
way.
So there's a stateless front end that just does this multicast.
Well, it like takes a fixed amount of data processes and then puts it onto a wired protocol and just pass each of the packets and just blast it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we call TCP like a leaky abstraction because it's still connectionless. But to get the idea of a connection, you have like quad and shatter.
Yeah.
Right. And then it just makes it very expensive, quite expensive. Very expensive.
And anybody's done a lot of work with TCP, it's a protocol that evolved over time by committee, and there's a lot of conflated concerns that are incredibly annoying. I wrote a network probe as one of the previous things I'd done, and you start looking at, well, how does it sequence packets and how does it size packets? They conflated the size of the packet along with the sequencing of the packet. So for annoying whether you've missed a packet in sequence, and this becomes annoying. So sometimes when you're knacking back, you've got a size of zero, but they also then increment the sequence, but it's like, but you haven't sent any data, so you end up having all these data tables to work out how to deal with all these conflated concerns, which is kind of nasty. Multicast or UDP, really, really simple. Packet comes in, it's not part of any other stream, it's a payload, it's fire and forget. You build your own reliability protocol on top of that, it's much nicer to deal with. So, but if you're reading multicast, the nice thing is you're just reading from one socket. You're not even reading across multiple sockets. You just pull in up the multicast. You can have a single thread putting things in here. Even better, multicast is limited in the size that the packets can be, and you can control that all much better than you can with TCP. So that's kind of history, but I also see a lot of TCP stuff. So what I typically do at this point is run a single thread non-blocking, reading in and putting, so I'll only have a single thread at this point. What's more commonly that I see is people run things like web servers, like other sorts of applications, where they've got a thread pool here putting into here, which means they've got to use the multi-producer side of the disruptor.
Like wrapping that in some kind of an after model to try to get some thread back in.
I can.
Still, the problem doesn't work because we just push the problem out, right?
Yeah. If you look at most of these frameworks out there that are dealing with sockets, the amount of buffer copying they do and thread handling is just so wrong. It's unbelievable. And it's a bit like the logging framework wars. They're all arguing about, I'm faster than this one. But Mike Barker sums it up really well. It's like arguing, is a Yaris faster than a Polo? And somebody else has got a Formula One car. That's the size. To comparing Netty and Jetty and all these sorts of things, then which one's faster? It's just ridiculous. They're all slow. They're all so unbelievably slow compared to where the real game is, which is kind of interesting. And so you could write something that's much more reactive. Like if somebody wants to go and take on something like Netty and do it right, go look at something like Nginx or G1 or inside of Resin or something and see how they're done internally and build up from that sort of model rather than build down with all of the buffer copying that happens in those other protocols. And all that buffer copying and allocation kills the GC as well. It's really horrendous on it, to how much gets allocated. But if you're in the multi-producer case, the other big thing to worry about here, older versions of the disruptor, and this is my bad, if you've got multiple producers and you have more producers than you have cores, is you can get it into a really pathological case. Because the algorithm I used for this originally expected you to have enough cores to run so that you were going to complete the steps in a given series of time. If it didn't, it used to become a real problem. So I've seen people use this with thread pools of hundreds producing into here, and all of a sudden they see all of their CPUs running at 100% and getting very, very small throughput rates. We made a change in Disruptor 3 that makes that much, much better, but at a cost of it reduced throughput overall by having to have a friendlier algorithm for that. So I think we're out of time, unless there's any more questions.
Probably. Do you think people can be properly doing those operations to try and exact the position of the next slide of the
system?
So, I think that secondary data class are able to do size from the ring buffer. If you have a framework to find the road solution, if you can avoid this operation.
So, do you think it's a question, right? Is the MODA operation a problem?
Is if you use the buffer, is it faster? Because you reduce the number of operations?
The two separate things there. The MODA operation is not a problem if you use a PAR 2 in size. Remainder operation in Java maps down to an I-divide operation in x86. A 64-bit version of that operation is 92 cycles. It is the most expensive instruction an x86 CPU can process. It is even worse than a memory buffer by a long way. Very, very expensive operation. How can I make that a single cycle operation? If my number is a PAR of 2 in size, and I do minus 1 on the PAR of 2 of that, I set all of the bits that are least significant from that point, I mask that number together, I have a single cycle remainder operation as a bit mask. So you make this a PAR 2 in size and the MODA operation goes away. You have to do bit masking. The compiler can only work that out if it sees it as a constant. It has to know this size as a compile time constant.
But it's a constant, it'll actually figure it out.
Yes, right. Compile time constant. And it has to be constant as a static. So this is actually one of the other annoying. Final instance final is not final, which is really, really annoying in how Java is implemented. You do not get constant propagation as a compiler optimization. And the reason for that is some of our friends and people like the Apache groups who use reflection to get rid of final and change variables because of that, the JVM vendors cannot make final truly final. They have to just treat them all as normal fields because of the bad behavior of some of our open source groups.
It's just that they recognize that people can do this, so they cannot do that. So they have to use static single sign or something like that.
Static file is in certain situations if you have a static initializer,
right,
and it's not part of the constant pool, then the compiler can
talk
about the price.
I know some of the vendors are looking at and call effectively final as an optimization, a bit like how we do class hierarchy analysis, is we make the assumption that something is never extended, we can make the assumption something's final and put a trap in, and that way we can actually do constant propagation. Because it's not the making it final, it's once we know that's a constant, algorithms can have constant propagation from that point.
Yeah, but that's why they interest the stacks and the science, right? The compile, because then you can sort that out. At runtime.
Oh, no, at runtime it still doesn't work. For an instance, it doesn't propagate. I've had some teacher discussions with Cliff and Gill on this. They would love to, but they haven't been able to do it properly.
I didn't know that. I think it worked. Because we used to mutate file field.
As soon as you do that, then you're going to get some traps and stuff like that.
Yeah, you probably find they won't change in a way because it's already been propagated at that stage.
Depending.
Yeah.
But rather than getting files, you can just put an end and stuff, which of course just makes the assumption that it is parallel. Maybe you have something that checks if it is parallel. Maybe on initialization.
Yeah. A very simple check I do is I always just search when I create things. I do a bit count on it, and if you've only set one bit, it's a PAR 2. Very nice simple check.
I have another quick question. You mentioned latest that looks like that has been wrong for a long time. I thought that was implemented just as a set on some architectures, one of which I think we're talking about.
Yeah, you're right. There's two parts to it. So most memory models are about the hardware and the software. x86 is a total store order memory model. So when any of you do store, so in processor people, they talk loads in stores, they don't talk reads and writes. So when if you do a store and you do another store after, those stores never get reordered on x86. It's total store order in how it does it. So the problem is actually the compilers. The compilers do far more optimizations than that. So what by doing lazy set in the JVM is it tells the compiler not to reorder. For x86, it'll end up doing the right thing. And if you look at Doug Lee's cookbook, it's actually a store memory barrier at that stage. Cool. Thank you all.